Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show. Welcome. President Bush, taking the cautious approach to environmental matters, waited patiently for a study by the National Academy of Sciences on greenhouse warming. The report, now released, is being received well at the White House. We'll talk with science advisor Dr. Alan Bromley. Also, the continuing battle to save the ancient forests in the Pacific Northwest. Indiana Congressman Jim Johns, sponsoring protection legislation, puts the crisis in perspective.
About 15% of the ancient forests, which once covered over 20 million acres in Oregon and Washington and Northern California, are left. The other 85% are gone. And we are cutting that last remaining 15% at a rate faster than what the rainforests in Brazil are being cut.
Some of the stories this time on The Environment Show. Do stay with us. The Environment Show is a national production of WAMC, made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. This is Bruce Robertson. A couple of years ago, Congress commissioned the National Academy of Sciences to prepare a thorough report on greenhouse gases and global warming. Recently, the panel, chaired by former Washington State Senator and Governor Daniel J. Evans, published the study, now the centerpiece of much discussion. On the one hand, environmentalists are poring over the report for evidence of support for conservation measures and alternative renewable energy sources. In general, the report does call for increased conservation measures and research into alternative fuels. But the report also includes a call for more nuclear power, using the so-called second generation of reactors. This has some in the environmental camp concerned. On the other hand, those in the White House and in support of the president's energy plan also view the report favorably, reading into the study a conservative slant by not calling for a cap on CO2 emissions. Overall, though, most agree with former Governor Daniel Evans, chairman of the study commission.
There's a lot to be said for the president's energy strategy. I think that our proposals go somewhat further than the president's current proposals, but they're not at sharp odds with one with another, nor are we at sharp odds with what many environmental groups are suggesting. I guess I'm saying that there's a lot more similarity clear across the spectrum than many people are willing to admit.
Shortly after the report was released, Energy Secretary James Watkins released a statement in support of the measures called for by the panel, measures that, in a nutshell, call for a reduction in greenhouse gases, this in spite of scientific uncertainty over whether global warming is occurring as a result of abnormal buildup of these man-made emissions. Said Watkins, "It provides us with an important benchmark for discussion about national energy policy in the coming months." For further reaction and analysis, we reached Dr. Alan Bromley, the official and personal science advisor to President Bush. How are you advising the president on the greenhouse effect?
Precisely the same as prior to this report. We have been extremely pleased in the administration by this report, by the extent to which its recommendations are almost coincident in a great many cases with those that we already have in place or have already proposed.
The biggest single reduction in this report, the calling for the biggest single reduction for greenhouse gas buildup, would come from eliminating the CFCs. Again, what are your recommendations?
There's no question that the largest reduction comes from elimination of CFCs, and there are two reasons why that is very important. Not only are the CFCs the most potent greenhouse gases that we know, but they also, because they contain halogens in their construction, when they are broken up in the upper atmosphere, liberate those halogens, and these act as catalysts to destroy the protective ozone layer.
The report also calls for a stepped-up new program or reinvigorating the nuclear energy program providing for our nation's energy future.
That is correct. Many
environmental groups, environmentalists, are either opposing, there are two camps, I guess, that some are opposing any reinvigoration of the industry, and some are coming around to recognizing that perhaps if we could be assured of the safety concerns, that perhaps nuclear power is one of the ways to provide for our power grid. What are your overall reactions to that emphasis?
Well, of course, I have always been a strong supporter of the nuclear option. We used it rather badly in this country, and I think that we cannot expect our public to accept any significant expansion of the nuclear option until such time as we have demonstrated to them that we have a new technology that is a so-called intrinsically safe one. And I think, too, that it is very important for us to keep in mind that the nuclear option is the only one available to us that can provide large blocks of electrical energy. And one of the things that's very important to keep in mind is that although our energy utilization has remained essentially flat since about 1974 in this country, our use of electrical energy has gone up in lockstep with our GNP growth, and I fully anticipate that that will continue.
The one of the other provisions in the National Academy of Science report, or one of the items they're calling for, is increased funding for research into alternative and renewable fuels. Now, I know the United States has, in the fiscal year 1992, proposing somewhere in the order of about a $500 million to be earmarked for research, and yet many are criticizing that amount as being far too small, certainly not in comparison to the funding, the subsidies that go for the fossil fuels and coal and natural gas and the like.
Well, the fact is that we are doing substantial research on a number of the alternative fuel systems, but the important thing to remember is that most of these alternative fuel systems at this point are still niche supplies. And so it is not surprising that the investment in them is not equivalent to what we have in fossil fuels, for example, or in nuclear fuels, where the demand is so much higher, the utilization is so much higher, and the thrust to improve our utilization is so much more severe. But I think that there's no question that the President has made a clear commitment to developing our use of alternative fuels, to doing research on alternative energy sources at a rate that's appropriate to that which the communities involved can absorb that funding.
Dr. Bromley, I wonder if you might reconcile for us or explain some of the differences between what is being called for in the NAS report and that being proposed by President Bush in placing a cap and limiting the total CO2 output. The report, I believe, calls for an actual reduction, where it's my understanding that the President's plan is to not actually reduce below a certain fixed level, but just control and slow the growth.
Now, that is not quite correct. There's been substantial confusion on this. The reason for the confusion is simply that in the Evans study from the Academy, they took the year 1990 and decided that they would not attempt to make any estimate of what the economic growth of the country would be in the out years. So they have a fixed point calculation for 1990, which they then simply extrapolate forward. And they recommend that, in fact, it is possible to reduce our net greenhouse gas emissions. And they do not talk about CO2 alone. They talk about net greenhouse gas emissions between 10 and 40% below that 1990 level. Now, in the work that we have done, that has been done by the Environmental Protection Agency and by the Council of Economic Advisers, we instead are assuming that the economy will be growing in the next few years. We're talking about a 3.5% growth, and then the growth rate is changed to reflect specific assumptions about the rate of growth, but there is growth built in all the way. And so the two statements that are being made are equivalent. Let me explain why. If you build in growth in the economy, then if nothing else happens, you would expect that the rate of emission of greenhouse gases would increase as we use more fuels, for example. The policies that the Bush administration has put in place, despite that growth, have assured us that we can hold our net greenhouse gas emissions to the 1990 level through the year 2030. Now, if we take the same basis of calculation that the Academy used and said, we'll forget about the growth and assume just the 1990 level, then, in fact, what we show on the basis of the policies that the administration has already in place and proposed is that by the year 2010, that we will be reducing our net greenhouse gas emissions to 25% below the 1990 level, and that's comfortably within the 10 to 40% recommended range.
Finally, Dr. Bromley, I wonder how you would characterize your position, your relationship with President Bush vis-a-vis these environmental questions. Do you and he sit together and talk privately and speculate about the future and share ideas?
We do, and I have the greatest respect for the president's points of view, and I believe he has that feeling for mine. And so I have been involved since I took the office here as at his request as chairman of the Domestic Policy Council Working Group on Global Change, so we've had numerous occasions to interact.
Dr. Alan Bromley, White House Science Advisor. This is Bruce Robertson. About a year ago, Starkist Tuna Corporation announced it was going to save the dolphins and no longer sanction or commit fishing practices that kill dolphins in the process of fishing for yellowfin tuna in the Central Pacific. Then last fall, a federal judge ordered the United States to accept no tuna from foreign fisheries that use these dolphin-killing techniques. Though U.S. fishing practices have been curtailing the dolphin kill, those of foreign fisheries have continued to kill up to 100,000 dolphins a year, the largest killing of marine mammals in the world. In fact, you may have heard our report last fall with Sam Labuddy of Earth Island Institute. He had smuggled himself aboard a Mexican tuna boat to film the dolphin killing. Labuddy was featured recently in Time magazine for his efforts. Well, now, Bumblebee Seafoods in San Diego may well get some recognition for a new technique recently demonstrated off the coast of California. Michael McGowan, Vice President for Corporate Development, says the new technique involves a combination of ancient and ultra-modern technology.
It's called a fish aggregating device, FAD, and what we're hoping to do with this, or it will lead to, is a solution of an alternative fishing method to fishing on dolphin, and it's targeted on the large tuna, which the tuna vessels catch with dolphin, and we're hoping this will lead to the eastern tropical Pacific Ocean, which is where the association between dolphin and tuna occur, that these alternative methods will allow the fishermen to still have a viable fishery in these waters.
Can you tell us how the FAD is going to work?
What it basically is, it could be any floating object, and FADs have been around for a couple of thousand years, actually, in one form or another. It could be a log or something. In this case, it'll be a man-made. And what we're doing that's different with this project is we're going to have a series of kites that will go at different depths from, say, 50 to maybe 200 fathoms of water, and the idea is to attract the larger fish up to the surface so they can be fished.
I'm sorry, you say a series of kites?
Well, the like underwater type of kites. Basically what happens, what a FAD does is it starts the whole life cycle. You have in the ocean, you would get an algae buildup, and an algae would attract the smaller fish, and the smaller fish attract the larger fish and the sharks, etc. And we're hoping to do that at depth to attract larger fish sooner and bring them up to the surface.
I wonder if you might be able to be a little more specific how this is going to separate the dolphin from the tuna.
Well, this is a method of fishing that doesn't attract the dolphin at all. Historically, the problem with this method of fishing is that generally smaller fish are caught by this method, and although there would be no harm to dolphin, you could easily overfish a stock of tuna and jeopardize that stock. The ideal for the tuna stock is to target it on the larger fish, which are the adult mature fish, and the stock of fish will be perpetuated that way. And so the dolphin don't congregate around the logs.
So essentially what you're doing is providing a habitat for the tuna, that a habitat in this instance that is not shared by the dolphin. So you're going to create an area where only tuna congregate and where you can fish, and the theoretically the dolphin will not.
Exactly. That's our hope.
McGowan says the devices will range up to 4 feet square and will be free-floating. The devices will be equipped with transmitters that will relay a signal to a satellite in orbit above the Earth. That signal, in turn, will be beamed back to the tuna boat, allowing the fishermen to chart the course of the floating habitat. McGowan says a series of 60 of these devices will be deployed throughout the next couple of months, another 60 later next fall. Environmental groups, including Earth Island Institute, reportedly are supportive of this experiment. In coming months, we'll have an update. This is Bruce Robertson. Recently, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service proposed extensive logging restrictions on 11.6 million acres of northwest forests to further protect the habitat of the threatened northern spotted owl. This announcement comes at the same time that Indiana Congressman Jim Johns is submitting his Ancient Forest Protection Act. Filed as H.R. 842, the bill is similar to the Ancient Forest Protection Act H.R. 4492, filed last year also by Representative Johns. As Johns explains, saving the northern spotted owl necessarily means saving the ancient forests.
About 15% of the ancient forests, which once covered over 20 million acres in Oregon and Washington and Northern California, are left. The other 85% are gone. And we are cutting that last remaining 15% at a rate faster than what the rainforests in Brazil are being cut. Scientists are of the opinion that perhaps we only have a decade or two of the existing activities that could be sustained before the ancient forests as we know them would cease to function as a viable ecological system.
And so, therefore, your bill, H.R. 842, has a number of leading titles to confront this and bring up some solutions. Can you tell us how you are approaching this crisis?
The basic idea of the bill is to create areas called Ancient Forest Reserve, which would be in addition to existing wilderness areas or areas that have been set aside to protect the spotted owl. And these areas would be identified based on their importance in sustaining the forest as an ecological system. The bill establishes a committee of scientists under the auspices of the Council on Environmental Quality to make recommendations to the Congress about what areas ought to be protected. The bill would put into interim protective status acreage which is now ancient forest in the Pacific Northwest, pending the outcome of the study.
In this year's bill, Congressman, you are talking about interim protection. What do you mean by interim? That connotes something that is temporary, and after a period of time, something else will come in its place.
Well, I think that scientists are not likely to recommend that every bit of ancient forest be protected permanently, but rather that significant portions of it are protected. And, of course, while these recommendations are being made, we want to preserve as many options as possible for future action by the Congress. So the bill does provide interim protection to a rather large area. Then when the scientific study is over, the Congress can take action based on the recommendations of the scientists, and then some of the areas can be released for general forest use.
Now, when you talk about interim protection, are you pinpointing anything? For example, are you calling for a halt in timber activity?
Oh, in the interim status as well as the ancient forest reserves, as they are designated, there would not be any cutting of trees. There wouldn't be any road building. These are the activities that have had the most serious impact on the ability of the ancient forest to function and the ability of the animal species within them to maintain viable populations. And those activities would be off-limits in the ancient forest reserves and the protected areas on an interim basis as well.
Mr. Johnson's proposal would be absolutely devastating for the Pacific Northwest economy, and particularly for the dozens of communities that depend directly on forest resources from the national forest lands.
Jim Geisinger, president of the Northwest Forestry Association.
His bill would essentially stop all harvesting of timber on federal lands in the Pacific Northwest.
The Portland, Oregon-based Trade Association represents about 70 manufacturers of lumber and plywood throughout Washington and Oregon. The NFA works with the federal government to establish a predictable and reliable source of timber from federally owned lands. The old growth or ancient forest is a very special ecosystem, says Congressman Johns.
An ancient forest is a forest which demonstrates certain characteristics that are the result of thousands of years of evolution and are characteristic of the forests in portions of the Pacific Northwest that have been untouched by logging or other human activities. Very important in the ancient forest are the snags, the dead trees that serve function for wildlife, and also the down woody debris that becomes the biological legacy that the forest depends on. These structural characteristics are more important in identifying an ancient forest than age by itself.
It stands to reason, then, that old-growth forests are not easily or rapidly replaced, certainly not in our lifetimes. The issue of sustainability is nowhere better demonstrated than in these forests. The question to the Northwest Forestry Association is, how can the industry sustain for the long term using techniques that cut down and eliminate the very basis of the business, the ancient trees? Geisinger says there are plenty of trees left.
According to the U.S. Forest Service, there's over 8 million acres of old-growth forests on federal lands in this region. Out of that acreage, almost 4.5 million acres is already preserved and off-limits to logging. Well over half of the remaining old-growth is already preserved. That portion that isn't reserved is being harvested at a rate of about 1 to 1.5% per year. It exists on land use allocations that were established under a forest planning process that was 16 years in the making, involved public participation and the input of literally hundreds of thousands of individuals and organizations. And on those lands, that timber is going to be managed on a sustained yield basis on a rotation that would allow the timber to grow back to maturity, perhaps not to 500 years old or 250 years old, but it would be grown on a rotation that is sustainable and would continue to provide the goods and services that those lands have traditionally provided. Mr. Johnson's legislation totally ignores that planning process that involved the opinions and the input of the citizens of the United States, and instead would simply legislate a lockup that would put literally 100,000 people out of work.
Congressman Johns says he has not included any titles in his bill that would address the economic issues, precisely because he says those concerns should and will be dealt with by those most affected.
Well, I definitely believe that legislation to protect ancient forests should be passed along with legislation to respond to the economic problems in the Pacific Northwest. These problems were not caused by the spotted owl. They are not the result of my legislation per se. They are the result of transitions that are now ongoing in the Pacific Northwest and are likely to continue. The level of employment in the wood products industry is going down in many communities, and there are steps that can be taken to respond. My legislation, as it's introduced, does not include economic provisions because I believe that we ought to be endorsing the proposals that come from the Northwest. Hopefully, the governors of Washington, Oregon, the congressional delegation from these two states, and other local interests will develop a package of economic attention that will be their recommendations about how to respond to these changes. and I will gladly endorse that package and work with them. But the ideas about how the transition should be made really properly should come from those in the Northwest themselves.
One of the steps Congressman Johns suggests can be taken to bolster the economy in the region would be to prohibit the export of logs to overseas mills. Jim Geisinger says the problem is more complicated than this.
Federal timber cannot be exported from the Pacific Northwest. The great preponderance of timber that's being exported are private logs that come from private lands. Our government has also taken steps to prevent those companies that export their private logs from buying federal timber. So we're really talking about two different segments of the industry, the large private landowners that export their logs and the companies that have traditionally depended on federal timber. If you take the supply away from those companies, there are no alternatives for them to get logs. And likewise, if you tell the private landowner that he can't export his own private property, that doesn't necessarily mean he's going to turn around and sell it to the mills that are in these communities that have traditionally depended on federal timber. So I think, in effect, what Mr. Johns is doing is mixing apples and oranges in two very different situations and trying to make a simplification out of it. It just isn't going to work.
What do you see as the ultimate and long-term solution for this?
We have always advocated a sustained yield of forest products from our national forest lands. But what level is sustainable depends directly on how much land is available to manage under a multiple-use concept, which would include timber harvesting. Under Mr. Johns's bill, there would be very little, if any, land left for that kind of practice, and instead it would all be totally preserved. So I think what has to be done is a legislative solution must be crafted and promoted by our Northwest delegation that establishes a balance of uses, and most importantly, leave that balance in place for a period of time so that we can learn to rely on a predictable, even flow of products from our forests. Anything less than that is going to continue the disarray and instability that we're experiencing today.
Congressman Johns says we need to keep in mind there are millions of acres of non-ancient forests, acres that his bill will not regulate.
We shouldn't take the last of the ancient forests, cut them up into chips or make them into veneer. We don't need to do that. We can use the other forest resources in the Pacific Northwest to meet the wood product needs of our country and at the same time preserve this last 15% of the ancient forests, which are now endangered.
Finally, Jim Geisinger.
If Mr. Johns's bill is passed, that's going to lock up enough timber to build 220,000 homes each and every year, year in and year out. And when we have a problem like we do with affordable housing in this country, I think it would be tragic to take land that is arguably the most productive forest land in the entire world and put it off limits to any kind of human uses is just unconscionable.
Jim Geisinger, president of the Northwest Forestry Association in Portland, Oregon. Congressman Jim Johns represents the 5th Congressional District of Indiana. His bill has 87 co-sponsors. This is Bruce Robertson. And that's our show for this week. This has been a WAMC national production. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.